This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's something we may take for granted today. Action movies with Asian American actors in leading roles. Stars depicted as strong, confident, attractive, and admirable. Hollywood used to portray Asian men as foolish and emasculated. Think of Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. And then came Bruce Lee.
Ultimately, martial art means honestly expressing yourself, to express oneself honestly, not lying to oneself, and to express myself honestly. Now, that, my friend, is very hard to do, and you have to train. You have to keep your reflexes so that when you want it, it's there.
Bruce Lee had everything an action star needed. Good looks, a magnetic presence, an impossibly athletic body, and an almost magical speed in fight scenes. He died nearly 45 years ago, on July 20th, 1973. It was just 1 month before his big hit Enter the Dragon debuted, but his legacy remains strong. How did this American original, and yes, he was American, he was born in San Francisco, become an icon? We'll find out in just a bit.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from CLR Bath & Kitchen. Which two rooms in your house get the most use? If you said the kitchen and the bathroom, you're not alone. And keeping these rooms clean is a never-ending job. CLR Bath & Kitchen makes it easy. Its fast-acting spray makes everything sparkle and gleam, from faucets and shower doors to porcelain and stainless steel, without phosphates, ammonia, or bleach. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Trust CLR Bath & Kitchen, making the world a little cleaner.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
Joining us now to discuss his legacy is Matthew Polly, the author of a new biography called Bruce Lee, A Life. It encompasses a decade's worth of research with more than 100 interviews with Lee's family and friends. Matthew, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me on.
I imagine you would not do this much work about someone who had not hooked you. I wonder when you got hooked on Bruce Lee.
Yes, I'm one of the prototypical Bruce Lee fans. I first saw his movie when I was 12 years old. I was one of those skinny, bullied kids, and Bruce Lee jumped off the screen into my imagination and became my childhood hero. I went out and bought a pair of nunchucks and cracked myself repeatedly in the skull with them, and then it led to a lifelong obsession. I went to the Shaolin Temple in China to study Kung Fu with the Shaolin monks, and became a martial arts writer. So like some of the people who just called in, Bruce set me on my life path. And writing this book was my way of paying back that debt.
You basically described me right up until the minute you left for the Shaolin Temple.
Like I
can still feel the dent in my head from where the nunchucks hit me. So that's when I was like, maybe I'll go be a journalist.
Talk about safer.
Marginally, I do live in Washington. Talk sure. About the work that went into making this book. You contacted a lot of people who I imagine wanted to let Bruce Lee's legacy rest, and that's one of the themes that comes up in this book is who gets to tell his story. What was the process of just researching this book like?
So it took 6 to 7 years to do the research. I went to Hong Kong for 6 months. I spent time in L.A. and Seattle. I talked to over 100 people who knew Bruce Lee, were friends with him, family members. And it was interesting. There were some people who wanted to keep the legend as it was, but then there were others who felt like the record needed to be corrected. And so I had an opportunity to talk to them, especially since many of them are getting up in age. I felt like the last chance to really get the story straight.
I think a lot of people who feel that Bruce Lee is very much a legend feel like they really know him, right? Because you've seen the interviews with him, some of which we'll play clips of as we continue our conversation. You've seen Fists of Fury and Enter the Dragon and Game of Death. And, you know, you've seen the movies and you know the man. But then there are all these details about his life that come out through your research. Give me an example of something that most people think they know about Bruce Lee, but they really don't.
Well, one of the things I found really profound was certainly when I was growing up, I thought of him just as a kung fu star, maybe this kung fu master who had wandered into movies by accident. It turns out that he came from an entertainment family. He faced his first movie camera when he was 2 months old. From the age of 6 to 18, he made 20 Cantonese films, ranging from melodramas to comedies, but none of them were kung fu films. So before he was the master that we know him as, he was a child kung fu star, the kind of Macaulay Culkin of Hong Kong.
There's an image. Macaulay Culkin doing kung fu. We will leave that aside as we continue our conversation with Matthew Polly, author of Bruce Lee, A Life. When did he actually begin to get notice for his potential as an action star?
What was interesting is he came to the States when he was 18 because he kept getting into trouble, getting into fights on the streets. And so his parents sent him away to try to straighten him up. And when he arrived in America, he looked around at what kind of roles Asians were being offered and said, to heck with that. I'm not going to play a houseboy or a pigtailed coolie on building the railroad. And so he decided he was going to become the Ray Kroc of Kung Fu, to launch franchises of Kung Fu studios across the country.
Ray Kroc, the man who turned McDonald's into a national franchise.
Exactly. And so he decided that he was going to give up acting and only become a martial arts teacher. And it was during a performance in 1964 in Long Beach that a producer in Hollywood noticed him and decided to cast him eventually as Kato in The Green Hornet. And that launched his career as a kung fu actor.
Let's talk a little bit more about how Asians were portrayed on screen before Bruce Lee. We mentioned Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Hollywood was very much a reflection of the prejudices at the time. California has had laws like the Chinese Exclusion Act, which were basically one of the most draconian racist laws that any state has ever passed. Matthew, talk about some of Bruce Lee's predecessors on screen.
That's a great point, and we have to be very specific. Susetsu Hayakawa was the first Asian actor to ever star in a Hollywood movie, but that was in 1915. He was a star in the era before sound, and as soon as sound came around, it exposed his thick Japanese accent, and he lost his position as a romantic leading man. And then Pearl Harbor ended the roles of Asians as heroes or leading men in Hollywood movies. And after that, they became a kind of emasculated stereotype. And so Bruce Lee was the first Chinese-American to ever star in a film and the first Asian since the advent of sound.
Let's bring in a few more guests who are fans of Bruce Lee, both his martial arts and his cinematic work. Joining us from NPR in New York is Lamont Hawkins, better known as U-God, a founding member of the legendary rap group Wu-Tang Clan. We spoke with him not too long ago about his recent memoir, Raw, My Journey into the Wu-Tang. U-God, welcome back.
Hey, Josh. How you doing there, boss man?
I'm good. Glad to hear from you again. And we're glad to hear from Jeff Yang, who is joining us from NPR West near Los Angeles. Jeff is co-host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce and author of the book I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action. He is also a CNN contributor. Jeff, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Jeff, where does your fandom of Bruce Lee come from? How did he make an impact on you?
I think it's hard to be an Asian American male in this half century and not have Bruce Lee essentially as a kind of a central figure in your life and in your kind of cultural context. Not only was he somebody who touched so many aspects of our lives, I mean, you know, everything from video games, comic books, you know, obviously film and television was permanently marked by his presence, but he was kind of the first Asian American guy, essentially, in our presence, in our lives, who represented a figure of aspiration, of heroism, and he had to counteract so many other images that were stereotypical and kind of horrible. So, yes, he was very central for me.
Before I come to you, God, Jeff, could you expand on that a little bit? I had the honor some years ago of interviewing the late author Alex Tizon, who wrote a book called Big Little Man about stereotypes about Asian and Asian American men, many of which we know, nearly all of which are horrible. And it seems like Bruce Lee went a long way toward beating back some of those stereotypes that are literally emasculating to men across the Asian diaspora.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not just about masculinity. It's also about the notion of being central to your own story. And I think one of the things that when Bruce was able to control his narrative, when he was able to make his own films, he was able to do was he made himself into an integral part of that sort of epic story we tell ourselves. Growing up as an Asian American, you know, you're always the sidekick. You're always somebody who sees your character as a comic figure at the edge of the screen or a villain, right? I mean, even Sesu Hayakawa, you guys, you know, mentioned in the earlier part of the conversation, his specialty was playing kind of the brooding, romantic villain of a lot of these stories. But Bruce was a hero. He was the guy who very much was the protagonist. And having that ability to, you know, just really own the screen was something that when you're a marginalized person, you just, when you see it, you cherish it.
You got, let me come to you and talk about your connection to Bruce Lee. There is something about Bruce Lee and Kung Fu culturally that directly connects with Black culture, especially hip hop culture. I mean, Jim Kelly was one of the stars of Enter the Dragon, so that was represented there. But how do you see the link between yourself and Bruce Lee's legacy?
Well, you know, when we was kids, you had bullies, and it was always the fact that he was, he represented to me the David and Goliath situation, you know, the small guy who took on big guys and broke them down. And where we come from, that was always, that was a you know, amazing feat for us, you know, in urban communities, you know. And he had books out, and the nunchucks, it seemed like everybody had his nunchucks, you know. I had a pair of his nunchucks too, so you know, he just his aura of just, you know, this little guy just whip, you know, just beat you up. It was like was phenomenal to us, you know, and it was just, I can't even explain it, man. As a kid, that was amazing to me, you know, and my, the grown ups, you know, it took me to the movies. When you saw him, he was just amazed at this guy, man. I can't. It's unfathomable this, with the things he did, you know.
Right. You also wrote in your book Raw about how you learned to fight, you know, street fighting style, and you talk in the book about how in a fight speed kills. It doesn't matter how strong you are, but if you're the fastest, you are more than likely going to win.
That's right. And he, in my book, I also talk about the 52 hand blocks, and that's a derivative from Bruce. I mean, he was talking about Jeff talking about the Wing Sung style. Wing Sung style was a closed quarter style of fighting, and 52 blocks consist of that closed quarter style, and that was also a street fighting. You know what I mean? We used that as in street fights and brawls back in the days. And I was taught how to fight like that. You know, how to block real close and how to get up on your opponent. And, you know, certain things I pulled from his books and utilized in altercations in the streets when I was growing up.
Well, and it's a matter of survival. I mean, if you get if somebody rolls up on you, you don't necessarily have the benefit of backing them up. You just kind of have to defend yourself wherever you are.
Well, as a fighter, you can't fight backing up. That's another thing, too, in fighting and all-out brawls. You have to move forward on your opponent. And also, at the same time as you move forward, you have to protect and move at the same time and with speed. You know what I mean? And he equivocated all that in his techniques to me as I saw it on TV and as I read his books as a kid. And, you know, I wasn't the only one reading his books. And, you know, kids in the neighborhood was just, you know, was picking up the style and incorporated that into street fighting.
Right.
You know, because, you know, believe it or not, people was out there actually back in the days before guns was big. People used the hands more than weapons, you know. So when you got to altercation as a kid, you kind of incorporated the kicks and the 52 block, which is a derivative from Bruce.
A number of you shared your comments about Bruce Lee's impact on the martial arts in your life. Colin wrote on our Facebook page, "As a continuing student of martial arts, Sifu Lee shaped my philosophy of personal and physical expression, drawing from all styles to have one style and then no style. He taught me that we learn not to fight, but to discover ourselves. Such a teacher." Matthew Polly, what about that aspect of Bruce Lee's legacy? It seemed like what made him so iconic was not just that he was this super fast, incredibly striking fighter, but that he was not a brawler, that he was almost a Jedi before the Jedi existed. He was a philosopher fighter.
That's exactly right. What's interesting about Bruce is he was an intellectual as well as a fighter. He studied philosophy at the University of Washington. He was obsessed with it. He had over 2,000 books in his library, which he annotated closely. He'd read Hume, Descartes, and he would try to incorporate his philosophical understandings into his martial arts. And one of his sort of most powerful sayings was, adapt what is useful, reject what is useless, add what is specifically your own. And that was his idea of that you are the truth and you should take tradition and make it work for you.
Jeff Yang, were there any aspects of Bruce Lee's philosophy that particularly resonated with you?
I think that the thing that was probably the central guidepost for me around Bruce's idea of the world, not just sort of personal betterment, was very much this idea that you could bring all things together, that, you know, race, ethnicity, culture, nationality, these are things which are just, you know, external manifestations, but people and, you know, the ability for people to actually transcend that was kind of at the core of the way he moved through society. I mean, you've got, even on this conversation, right, you've got people from three different communities, all of whom have been deeply impacted by Bruce, and he taught students of all backgrounds and ethnicities. He probably was more popular to, Ugad's point there, within the African-American community before he was even embraced by white Americans. And that sense of egalitarianism and kind of dismissal of this notion that these sort of aspects of ourselves that are external are important to who we are, I mean, that was as much a transformative message as anything that he did in his philosophy around, you know, betterment and you know, kind of personal growth.
There's one particular clip of his philosophy, Ugad, that speaks to his sense of adaptability. I wonder if this is one of the clips that most resonated with you. But first, here's a clip of what I think is one of Bruce Lee's most famous quotes about his philosophy. Listen.
I said, empty your mind. Be formless. Shapeless, like water. Now you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Ugad, I wonder if that was one of the aspects of his philosophy that resonated
most. That's my favorite quote.
Yeah.
I live by that every day. You know, when I wake up, you know, when things are rough, I gotta roll with it. You know, it's the concept of quick adaptation. You have to adapt because you know your mind wants to do things, but your body got to catch up sometimes. You know what I mean? Sometimes your body want to do things and your mind has to catch up. And I got that at a real young age. The adaptation of your environment. When you're in harsh conditions, you might have to be rough. When you're in a soft situation, you might have to be soft. You know, and I don't know. That was the most simplest way he put it. And to me, it just got a quick, when I was a baby, when I was a kid, when I first heard that, I just got a good understanding of what he meant. And yeah, it just resonated with me.
Well, and you also talk, I remember from your book, you talk about some of the guys that you grew up with who were not adaptable, who were hard all the time, and they couldn't turn it off. And
yes,
so life just kind of ran them over because they didn't know how to flow in different, you know, ways of life or different situations, and they just couldn't make it.
That's right. And what I mean is by that is also that I always tell, you know, the little kids in the streets, you know, who want to be tough guys, I'll be like, yo, there's always going to be somebody tougher.
Right.
There's always going to be somebody rougher. There's always going to be somebody bigger and bolder. So you got to understand and be able to stand down, you know what I mean, and at certain situations. But, you know, some of them listen and some of them don't, you know.
Let me get to a few more of your comments. Christy tweeted us, I was a child born in 1970 to a father whose idol was Bruce Lee. My father died when I was 5, but the memories of him posing, breathing, moving, and emulating Bruce Lee are forever etched in my soul. Jeff emailed, Bruce Lee inspired me to train in and eventually teach the martial arts. I'm now fortunate enough to have trained in his martial arts system under Sifu Den in Osanto and now teach it myself. Bruce Lee's effect on the martial arts was equivalent to that of Mozart on music. Matthew, one more aspect of Bruce Lee's self-taught philosophy that I think is worth noting. In addition to martial arts, I understand he also had a record, or a reputation, rather, in Hong Kong as a cha-cha dancer?
Yes.
Is that true?
It is true. People talk about Bruce. One of his girlfriends in college said he was a kinetic genius. He could just take movement and adapt them. And one of the reasons he's so powerful on screen is because his movements have a dance-like quality. And when he was growing up, he studied the jitterbug, the two-step, and cha-cha. He went to a contest and competed and became the cha-cha champion of Hong Kong. And so he taught cha-cha when he first came to America before he taught kung fu. And he often said those were his two great loves and had trouble deciding which one he would dedicate his life to. And he ended up going with kung fu.
I kind of like him even more now. Yeah. It almost makes me like him more. One quick question we should get to before we have to pause. Franklin in Raleigh, North Carolina, not asking about Bruce Lee's dancing, but asking about the martial arts. Franklin tweeted, please someone talk about the 6-inch punch. Matthew, I wonder if you could get to that before we have to pause. I had always heard it called a 2-inch punch, but what is that?
And so it started at 6 inches and it got itself to 2. His idea was that if you were completely relaxed and then at the last moment snapped every muscle of your body in one direction, you could create a tremendous amount of power from a short distance. And so to demonstrate that, he would have people stand in front of him and he would do the 1-inch punch and knock them back 6 feet over chairs. And so it was one of his sort of demonstration techniques, and for which he became incredibly famous.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation about the life and legacy of Bruce Lee. We're speaking to Jeff Yang, CNN contributor, co-host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce, and the author of I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action. Matthew Polly, the author of Bruce Lee, A Life, and Lamont Hawkins, You God, from the Wu-Tang Clan, the author of Raw, My Journey into the Wu-Tang. Douglas emailed, Bruce Lee showed me that you didn't have to be 250 pounds to be an athlete. He also taught me some pretty good fighting moves. When my son was 10, we took Taekwondo together, and our sensei thought that I had taken Taekwondo before, but it was all Bruce Lee. I could do a butterfly kick almost as a natural motion. Kinshasa Moon wrote us on our Facebook page, and Matthew, maybe you can answer this one. Kinshasa writes, I love Bruce Lee. Please talk about the sounds he made. His sounds are never duplicated and cannot be imitated. What about that, Matthew? I feel like, and I don't even want to imitate it because that will feel like automatically racist for me to say it, but the sound of Bruce Lee fighting has become kind of the canonical kung fu sound. Was that just him? Was that common at the time when we first discovered it through him? What's behind that?
That was one of the great mysteries. Almost every person I interviewed, I asked about that, and absolutely no one knew. He once told one of his stuntmen, this is just the sort of thing I do when I'm fighting on the streets, but no one remembers him ever doing that when he was fighting on the streets. So we think he just made it up. Somehow, when he was doing the movies, he started doing it, and he got a reaction, and he realized this was something that he wanted to do. But we have no idea where that comes from, and that's certainly not traditional Chinese kung fu.
So maybe just a little bit of a cinematic showmanship?
I think so.
Jeff, there's a question I'd love you to answer from Irene in Adelphi, Maryland. Irene emailed, to the detriment of the living room furniture, me and my family would practice Bruce Lee moves on each other. Did your guest see, and what did he think of the 2016 movie Birth of the Dragon?
Great question. So Birth of a Dragon was controversial in a lot of ways because it took Bruce's identity, not so much his story. I mean, it wasn't meant to be a biography, but rather the presence, the protagonist image that he'd created on screen, and then kind of turned it into fantasy. Right? It was this amazing and very strange buddy film, which jumped off of the known facts about Bruce and then took it into a very strange and amazing and kinetic direction, comic direction in some ways. But it sort of speaks more broadly to this compelling nature of the stories and framework in some ways that Bruce created. Just about everybody, everything that we see right now in popular culture in some way or another was influenced by Bruce's ideas and by what he put on screen. You know, again, video games. We would not have this billion-dollar industry built around, you know, things like Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, things like that, without the ideas that Bruce put on screen first. And, I mean, it just speaks to the resilience of his ideas and the fact that people have been able to kind of imagine things beyond what Bruce was himself.
That might be a good place to play another clip from Bruce Lee regarding the roles that he would and would not take in Hollywood. We alluded to that a little bit earlier, but here's a clip from an interview on the Pierre Burton Show in 1971, talking about the representation of Asians on screen.
What are you going to do? Let's get back to the question.
Okay.
Are you going to stay in Hong Kong and be famous? Or are you going to go to the United States and be famous? Or are you going to try and eat your cake and have it too?
I am going to do both because, yeah. You see, I have already made up my mind that in the United States, I think something about the Oriental, the true Oriental should be shown.
Hollywood sure as heck hasn't.
You better believe it, man. I mean, it's always that pigtail and bouncing around, chop, chop, you know, with the eyes slant and all that.
Bruce Lee speaking on the Pierre Burton Show in 1971. Jeff, let me stick with you for a minute. I wonder how far you think Hollywood has come since Bruce Lee hit the scene in terms of improving representations of Asians and Asian Americans.
It took half a century to get where we are today, right? Where we finally have depictions of Asian Americans that feel a little bit more authentic and that put us at the center of the narrative. And it does very much make you wonder. I wondered this all the time. What would have happened if Bruce had lived more than 32 years? I mean, the guy, he understood the nature of image and how important it is to society and to each of us as individual human beings from birth, because, you know, he was, again, a performer from virtually birth. And even martial arts itself, as much as people think of him as a fighter, he was very much cognizant of the performing role of martial arts. I mean, martial arts came about in many ways and spread because of performance. It was something that was a part of Chinese opera, you know, sort of central cultural element of Chinese culture. And so that line between the things that are done for real and the things that are done for show has always been there. But Bruce knew very, very well that the things he was doing weren't just transformative for him. They could change things for an entire people. And, you know, obviously that's something which 50 years later we're still seeing.
Matthew Polly, we would be remiss if we did not talk about the circumstances surrounding Bruce Lee's death in 1973. There have been so many versions of this story. There was a strong effort to try to change the official account that came out in the basically minutes and hours after he died. What did you learn in your research for this book that could clear up once and for all how Bruce Lee actually died?
So what you said is quite correct. I ended up interviewing for my book Raymond Chow and Betty Ting Pei, the two people to last see him alive. What happened was that he died in Betty Ting Pei's apartment, and Raymond Chow, trying to cover up their affair, said that he died at home with his wife.
And I beg your pardon, I'm sorry, Betty was an actress with whom he'd had an affair, and Raymond Chow was a film executive that was working with him?
That's exactly right. So okay. Raymond Chow was the head of Golden Harvest Studios and Bruce Lee's business partner, and Betty Ting Pei was an actress working in Hong Kong, and she and Bruce were dating. And so Raymond Chow wanted to cover up that fact, and he told the press that Bruce died somewhere else. And when the press discovered this, the deception, it turned into a tremendous scandal in Hong Kong, and all sorts of conspiracy theories arose. And so for 45 years, people have been trying to figure out why exactly he died. There was a coroner's inquest that said it was an allergic reaction to aspirin. The conclusion of my book is that I think the most plausible scenario is he died from heat stroke. It was the hottest day of the summer, that day, and a couple months earlier, he had had the sweat glands in his armpits surgically removed, which it would have made it harder for him to dissipate heat.
Now, see, that's a rumor that I've heard for a long time. Was that actually true? He did have that surgery?
He did, yes.
It almost seems like the studio knew in the moment that his death was going to elevate him to some kind of legendary status. Were they just trying to protect his reputation or just trying to protect their bottom lines?
I think they were trying to do both. Andre Morgan, who worked at Golden Harvest, told me they were looking to protect the feelings and reputation of his wife, Linda, and the children. But they also had a huge investment in Enter the Dragon, which was about to come out. And so, like all studios, they cared about that as well. And they were worried. It was a more conservative era. They were worried that this would damage his reputation and his box office appeal. I don't think they had any idea that Bruce Lee – they knew he was famous then, but they had no idea that he would turn into – become the most famous Chinese-American to ever live.
I know we're winding down, but Jeff, I wonder how important you think the circumstances of Bruce Lee's death actually are in the context of his larger legacy. How much attention should we pay that?
I mean, I don't think they should be obsessed over on some level, because it was more about how he lived than how he died that mattered to us and for us. At the same time, I mean, you know, one of the things he always said was that honestly expressing yourself should be the heart of who you are. It should, you know, martial arts all about honest expression. And that desire to kind of control the narrative and to paper over the human aspects of him is something which I think he probably himself would have rejected. It's one of those things where we don't need to look at things from the sensationalistic lens and kind of fetishize the tawdry. But he was human. He was perhaps the most humanist individual of his era in his philosophy and his thinking. And to think otherwise kind of turns him into more of a picture than a person.
Jeff Yang, CNN contributor and the co-host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce, also the author of the book I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action. Jeff, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Lamont Hawkins, you got a founding member of the Wu-Tang Clan. He's the author of Raw, My Journey into the Wu-Tang. You got, thanks again.
Thank you for having me, boss.
And Matthew Polly, the author of Bruce Lee, A Life. Thank you, Matthew.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Remember, you can connect with us about upcoming episodes and debates online at the1a.org. That's the word the, the number one, the letter a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.